Good evening. It is Monday, June 29th, 2020, and it is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. As COVID-19 ravages Arizona and Houston and Fort Lauderdale, Florida, here are the current national numbers. There are now 2.59 million confirmed cases, up by 40,691 from yesterday. 789,000 people have recovered, and unfortunately, 128,000 people have died. That's up by 250 cases from yesterday. The New York Times has broken the story. Russia secretly offered Afghan militants bounties to kill U.S. troops, intelligence says. This story, as currently being reported, makes absolutely no sense to me. First, the opening sentence of today's story in the New York Times states, quote, American intelligence officials have concluded. Who are these vague, unmentioned officials? Second, staying in the same sentence, quote, Russian military intelligence units secretly offered bounties to Taliban-linked militants for killing coalition forces in Afghanistan, end quote. Why would Russia have to offer bounties to the Taliban? They kill U.S. forces for free. Third, I don't know that Russia has the type of relationship with the Taliban where this whole thing would make any sense. Enough for me. Let's talk with my first guest. He works for Tell the World, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington, D.C. During his 27 years as a CIA analyst, he led the Soviet foreign policy branch and prepared the president's daily brief for Presidents Nixon, Ford, and Reagan. In retirement, he co-created Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, or VIPS. He is Ray McGovern. As always, Ray, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer.
Now, you've just published a piece entitled WMD, Whores of Mass Distraction, Put Trump in Putin's Pocket. Your thoughts on my comments about this story and the story itself?
Well, Wilmer, I couldn't agree more. This is about as dubious a report as you can manufacture. I said WMD in a new incarnation, Whores of Mass Distraction, because that's what the mainstream media is doing precisely now. I see it as kind of a last gasp effort to breathe some new life into the whole general subject or issue of Russiagate. Russiagate has fallen on bad times. You'll recall all the drum beating by Rachel Maddow and just about everybody else. It's all fallen flat. There was no collusion. The Department of Justice dropped the case against the Internet Research Agency, which was supposed to have thrown the election to Trump, having represented, the portion of Facebook ads that the Internet Research Agency of Russia's St. Petersburg, the portion that they occupied of the whole exposure of Facebook during that period of time, a good bit of which was after the election. That percentage was, you got a pencil? 0.0000025. I don't know what that is. But, you know, so that fell by the wayside. So what do they have left? Well, they have Russian hacking. Now, most of your audience probably doesn't know this because it hasn't been in the mainstream media. But, and this is important, so I'll say it slowly. On December 5th, 2017, so what's that? That's 2.5 years ago. The head of CrowdStrike is the cybersecurity firm that the Democratic National Committee hired to look into its computers at the DNC. The head of CrowdStrike on the 5th of December, 2017, testified under oath that CrowdStrike has no concrete evidence that anyone hacks the DNC emails out of the DNC computers or server. The way Sean Henry, the head of CrowdStrike, put it was, we have no evidence that the data was exfiltrated, fancy word for hacked, out of the DNC. We often have such good data that we can pinpoint it, but in this case, we don't have any data that this was exfiltrated. Now, this is really key. This is key to the whole Russiagate thing. That's how it started, the Russian hacking of the DNC, remember? And what they were relying on was this crowd of CrowdStrike, which James Comey, for some strange reason, allowed to do the forensics on the DNC rather than have the FBI do it themselves. So what I'm saying here is the death knell for Russiagate writ large came on the 5th of December, 2017, in secret testimony, this time under oath. Makes a big difference when you have your lawyer next to you and tells you what you can say, what you can't. This time under oath by Sean Henry, the head of CrowdStrike. Now, why do I say all that? Well, because that testimony was not revealed, was not unclassified until the 7th of May this year. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, that's pretty late. But what do we have today? What's today? The 28th, the 29th? 29th, I guess.
June.
Now, the way I count that, 7 weeks, 7 weeks since this news broke. And the New York Times, as far as I know, has not said word one about it, nor has anyone else. Now, it's coming to push the show here because Barr, the attorney general, and John Durham, the U.S. attorney he's got working for him in Connecticut, are looking into the whole origins of Russiagate. And they're finding things that are highly embarrassing to people like James Comey, people like the major media that beat the drums for Russiagate. And so it's coming to a head, and I see this cockamamie story as the last gasp of those who want to make sure that they've misled the American people into thinking, no, the Russians are really bad, and this is what they did.
One of the first things that jumped out at me when I read the first New York Times story on this issue was they said that the intelligence was based in part on interrogation of captured militants. As soon as I saw the word interrogation, that put in my mind torture. And because we know that in many regards, as it relates to the United States, that those two words are synonymous. So that right there put the seed of doubt in my mind. And I know in your article, you write about that.
Yeah, my colleague and veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity, Scott Ritter, wrote this up immediately. What he said was the biggest clue concerning the fragility of the New York Times report is contained in one sentence. The one sentence it provides about sourcing. And this is a quote. The intelligence assessment is said to be based, at least in part, on interrogations. Your word, interrogations. Of captured Afghan militants and criminals. Now, Scott points out that says all you need to know about the intelligence in question, because the source of the information is most likely the Afghan government itself through its own, quote, interrogators, end quote, since the U.S. Army gave up the notion of interrogating people in Afghanistan several years ago. So what we have here are trained interrogators by the CIA years ago under the rubrics obtaining in those times. And so the veracity of the information that they come up with in these interrogations, plus the interests and the access to grind on the part of the government in Kabul, bespeak a judicious reluctance to take all this stuff at face value. I compliment Scott Ritter because he was first off the block, so to speak, to point out that key fact. So even if you want to try to give credence to this cockamamie story, you have to look at that evidence. And if most of it comes from interrogations, you are quite right again, Wilmer. It's a dubious provenance.
There's also more of a broader historical, what I'll call relationship context, in terms of you go back to Russia and Vietnam and draw some parallels, basically saying that it just wouldn't make sense for Russia to get involved with the United States and Afghanistan the same way that Russia didn't want to get involved with the United States in Vietnam, that it just made more sense for them to sit back and let the United States, I'll say, what, get hoisted on their own petard.
Yeah, sadly, I have a lot of friends that are dead because of all this, so it's sad. You're quite right. You pointed out before, Wilmer, that Russia is no friend of the Taliban. That's for sure. I mean, Russia's got its own terrorist threats in that part of Central Asia. So there's that. And then there's this whole business about, what incentive would Russia have to do this kind of thing? Number one, as you point out, the Taliban, even its spokesman over the weekend said, we don't need any help from outside. We'll target kill a whole bunch of people. You know, like my grandchildren say, I do it all by myself, We do it all by ourselves. Well, that's what the Viet Cong did. It was very clear. Everyone who knew anything about Vietnam, sadly, not so many here in this country, it's very clear that the Viet Cong, the North Vietnamese is going to win. They always repel the invader, even if it was China, the monster state just to its north. So, here are the Russians, and I have to tell you that I was the chief referent in the U.S. government. I was working as a CIA analyst on Soviet policy toward China and Vietnam. And I could see that the Russians entered the fray, so to speak, by pledging support for its fraternal socialist neighbor, Vietnam, and said, we'll give them a couple of surface-to-air missile sites and we'll prove our solidarity that way, but we're not getting involved any deeper than that. And so they sat back and they watched the inevitable happen without getting personally involved. Now, the same is true of Afghanistan. The Russians know that in a very personal way from the fight they fought in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. It was a painful lesson. And they knew that the Taliban is going to eventually win. The U.S. would have to withdraw. So what incentive? Give me a break. What incentive would the Russians have to say, hey, you guys don't need this money, and I know you're going to kill as many Americans as you kill you, but here's some cash, And where'd that cash come from,
Well, now to that point, because I've read some other stories that said that the United States forces, they invaded some Taliban stronghold and they found $500,000 in U.S. currency. And my response was, and so what's your point? All that shows me is the Taliban understands that the U.S. dollar is the world currency. They understand it like everybody else understands it. What's the point? And, this in and of itself does not show that they were paid to do anything.
That's true. The whole thing is concocted in a very haphazard way. The only people who will believe this stuff are, sadly, 80% of the American people.
So let me ask you this. What about the part of this story where the president says, nobody briefed me on this because my intelligence people just told me that they thought the whole thing was bogus and there was no need to tell me anything. One instance where Donald Trump makes sense?
Well, I used to work on the president's daily brief. I prepared it for Nixon and for President Ford, and I briefed it in the early mornings downtown, one-on-one, from 1981 to 1985. Never in my wildest dreams would I have taken this kind of report and put it in the president's daily brief, still less would I have briefed it to the folks downtown. These were top-level people, the highest national security officials, plus the president himself. So, I know what the threshold is, and the notion that anyone, even not so much admired directors like Gina Haspel, who oversaw torture at one of the black sites, even people like that, you know, would have enough sense not to bother the president with this. So that was the big rap. We're going to get the Russians, I'm going to get the president, and we're going to say the president knew about this and he didn't do anything. And that's because he's a friend of Putin. That's because he's in Putin's pocket. Okay. Well, the reality was, the president, though, didn't know anything about this. I think he's telling the truth here because the nature of the information was so shabby that anyone who bothered the president with this kind of stuff would have been derelict in their duty. So when he said late last night, look, you know, I just checked with the intelligence people, and they told me the reason they didn't tell me of that, this is because it was of dubious provenance, and it was not valid enough. What more do you need? Now, that should have taken the pizzazz out of the argument that here is Trump in Putin's pocket, and he knows about Putin killing American soldiers, like Rachel Maddow said on Friday night, taking American scalps, she said, scalps of American soldiers, paying for them. Now, that should have let the air out of that, but no. The New York Times this morning, because mm-hmm. they had nothing better to add, called attention to this Boston College historian who did a little chronology. I'll just give you a couple of things. April 1. Russian plane brought ventilators and other medical supplies to the United States, a propaganda coup for Russia. Number two, Trump raised eyebrows by issuing a joint statement celebrating the meeting on the Elbe, the 75th anniversary of it, where Germany was defeated by both the Allies. May 3rd, Putin and Trump talked for an hour and a half. And you know what Trump said? He called it, quote, very positive. May 21. The U.S. sent a humanitarian aid package worth $5.6 million to Moscow to help the coronavirus there. The shipment included 50 ventilators with another 250 promised for the next week. Wow. And finally, we're withdrawing troops from Germany, which, as this Boston College professor says, these troops are the ones that are necessary to support NATO against, you know what, Russian aggression. So, you know, here's the Times digging pretty deep into this lady's blog. She's a historian, but an expert on the Civil War. But they'll take what they can and call attention to it. Push is coming to shove, Wilmer. In the next months, the U.S. attorney who's looking into the origins of Russiagate is going to be looking at everything, including what was called the intelligence community assessment, saying that Putin himself directed the hacking of the DNC. Now, we know that's not true. We know there's no evidence of that. But mm-hmm. what happens? What happens when they question the sacred cow of the intelligence community assessment? Now, only two words of those three are correct. No, only one word is assessment. The other two wasn't the intelligence community. It was the FBI, the CIA, and the NSA. A cabal. And it wasn't mm-hmm. even they. It was, quote, hand-picked analysts. Who picked them? The guy named James Clapper, who famously said the Russians are almost genetically driven to be deceitful, to Putin, blah, 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 blah. So you know, it's coming to a head. And not only will these folks who have been named by the president and the attorney general, I'm talking about John Brennan of the CIA, Comey of the FBI, Clapper of the Director of National Intelligence. Not only are these people going to take it on the chin, but so will the major media, if there's any honesty left in the media in the world. And of course, that's a dubious if.
So to that point, are they going to roll these guys out in support of this ridiculous story? And what, in your opinion, is happening with this so-called briefing that's taking place to Congress?
Which briefing are you referring to?
Well, that right now the Congress demanded that they be briefed about what the president knew, and did the intelligence community, was he ever briefed on this or was he not? And if not, why not? That's supposed to be taking place today. So my question to you is, in your opinion, because I know you're not there, what's happening in this briefing and where are the former intelligence directors on this issue? And I know you said they're going to take it on the chin, but I'd like for you to elaborate on that.
Yeah. Well, they're sort of waiting in the wings. You know, I have said for months now that if I were Attorney General William Barr, I would take their passports. I'm referring to John Brennan, James Clapper, and James Comey. They are flight risks. The evidence is abundant of how they played fast and loose with the law, the Constitution, and regulations, first to try to prevent Trump from winning, and second, trying to destroy his presidency and not allow him to reach out to Russia for a more decent relationship. Now, my wife always warns me, Ray, you have to tell them, to tell the people what you think of Trump. And I think Trump is the worst president we ever had. Mm-hmm. But my oath is to the Constitution, okay? Mm-hmm. There's no expiration date on my oath to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
And domestic. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to keep doing that. And so will my friends, despite the opprobrium that attaches to appearing to be siding with Trump and the arch-villain Vladimir Putin. We're going to do that because that's the right thing to do, not because that helps Trump. We do that because, despite the fact that it helps Trump, we do that because we still do the truth, and we do the judgments the way we see them, and probably we're the only act in town that has the freedom to do that, since most of us are retired and most of us know what we're speaking about.
And so quickly, what is Congress being told now as they're being briefed on this whole fiasco?
Well, they're being told, I'm sure, if it's the intelligence people talking to them, that they didn't brief the president on this because it was a cockamamie story. It was tendentious because it came from the Afghans and their, quote, interrogations, end quote. And it, as you pointed out before, it just didn't make any sense. Taliban, we could do this all by ourselves. You know, we don't need any bounty, you know. So, you know, I think that's what they're being told. This is not to say that the major media will not distort all this. And we can see more of this tomorrow morning in the New York Times. It really is shameful.
But wait a minute, real quick. So if that's what they're being told, then I'm sure when they come out of the briefing room that there are going to be all kind of cameras around them, whether it's Pelosi or whoever, whatever committees are being briefed, and they're going to say, what'd they say? And are they going to say, well, it's top secret, we can't tell you? Or are they going to say, oh, this is a load of crap, we need to move on?
Well, there'll be two stories. There'll be the Republican one and there'll be the Democratic one. The Democratic one will be the one that the line that Nancy Pelosi took yesterday, Putin bad, 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 and all roads lead to Putin.
Okay.
The Republican one will be more defensive of the president.
Okay. Ray McGovern, as always, Ray, thank you so much for your time. Phenomenal analysis, as always, and look forward to having you back.
You're most welcome.
Thanks, Ray. Folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. That was a great get right there. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, global COVID-19 cases top 10 million as HHS Secretary warns window is closing to get disease back under control in the U.S. This is according to Common Dreams. Confirmed global cases of the coronavirus hit 10 million yesterday, a grim milestone that came as reported deaths from the disease climbed toward 500,000, and a top U.S. health official warned the country's chances of getting the outbreak back under control were fast disappearing. While according to the Washington Post, rising economic nationalism was already chipping away at a globalization before the first patients in Wuhan, China began to fall ill in December. But the coronavirus, which has sickened at least 9.6 million people and killed more than 480,000, is now reshaping long-standing cultural, economic, and political relations in an increasingly polarized world. Let's discuss how the COVID-19 pandemic health concerns are impacting rising economic nationalist issues. For insight in this, we turn to my next guests. First, on the public health side, she's a board-certified pediatrician and obesity medicine specialist. She's on the faculty at the Milken School of Public Health at George Washington University and has a telemedicine practice called Ask Dr. Yola. She is Yolandra Hancock. Dr. Hancock, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
On the economic nationalism side, he's the National Economic Association president and associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Linwood, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
So let me start, Yolandra. Data from Hopkins, which has tracked the disease for months, showed the total confirmed cases around the world at over 10 million by early yesterday. Quote, "This is a very, very serious situation, and the window is closing for us to take action and get this under control." That's HHS Secretary Alex Azar. He said this on a number of news shows yesterday. I'm going to use a very, very technical political science term.
Yeah.
So,
no, well,
go ahead.
We can't cuss, so I'm not going to. But no, you know what, Sherlock.
Right. They just don't get it.
No, they don't. They haven't. And my clinical suspicion is that they won't. We see a continued behavior since the start of this pandemic. It's denial. It's denial and further denial. The numbers don't lie. It is what it is. When you see across the country states reaching record high numbers of new cases, higher numbers of new cases now than at our supposed peak just a month and a half or two ago. This speaks to states and our country's failure to contain this virus and to act appropriately.
Is the window closing or is it closed?
To be honest with you, given how polarized and politicized this now is, I would say that the window is closed. There's just, you know, when the dust comes in, the pollen seeps in through the sill of the mm-hmm. window, that's about as much space as we have to contain. When continuously the severity and the significance of this virus have been denied by our top officials, it's hard to put the horse back in the barn when it's run around track after track after track and picked up speed. People are no longer convinced that it's threatening, and they're doing what they want to do. They're not following any recommendations.
Dr. Taheed, travel is one of the clearest ways to show how, this is according to the Washington Post, how the coronavirus has disrupted the world. Like the fire through Notre Dame, the coronavirus pandemic has now silenced this cathedral of interconnectedness. And one of the examples that they use is Singapore's Changi Airport, where now that place is almost like a ghost town. Your thoughts on this whole economic nationalization issue and what this is doing to the globalized economy?
Well, you know, certainly air travel has been decimated, is down seriously. But, you know, people are now online doing business online. Business meetings are being conducted online. So if we look at business activities, I think those activities are continuing to go on, even though they may not be facilitated by travel. Tourism is a different situation. Folks are not traveling to tourist spots. And those economies that are very dependent upon tourism, for example, economies in the Caribbean, are being decimated by this decline. Points to a couple of things in terms of economics. One, it points to the weaknesses that an economy can have if it's dependent too much on one particular product or service. If an economy can be completely destroyed because the tourism industry goes away, then that economy is what we call a mono economy. And those traditionally have been weak economies that have always been affected by economic downturns of various kinds. And so, you know, the idea that globalization has its problems is not a new thing. Economists have been talking about the problems with globalization for a couple of decades here. After, at least mainstream economists thought that globalization would do well for all parties, that lower income nations would see their income rise, and that higher income nations would see a increase in their products and the price of products would come down. We've not seen very much of that, of either of those cases. In fact, we've seen, for example, trade with, to give an example, Nike shoes. I mean, Nikes are no longer manufactured in the U.S., but they're more expensive than they ever were. And so the question is, where's the revenue going? And the answer is going into profit, and it's going into shareholders. It's not benefiting regular workers. Nor are very many workers in other countries being benefited as well as they work to produce these products.
Dr. Hancock, we now know Houston is moving to severe COVID warning, and we know that Fort Lauderdale, Florida, is now demanding masks. I think the president wanted to move part of the Republican convention from North Carolina to Fort Lauderdale because of the weaker requirements as it relates to COVID-19, but now Fort Lauderdale isn't safe. Your thoughts on these spikes that we're seeing? And, you hate to say I told you so, but I told you so.
Exactly. I'm not going to do the dance while I talk to you. But absolutely, the states which were the latest to close and the earliest to open are also the states that we're seeing with the highest number of new cases. We're talking cases higher than when the pandemic reached its alleged peak back in April. When you use a state like Texas as an example, that is setting record high numbers. Not only that, but they're getting ready to max out their ICU capacity. The Texas Medical Center hospitals collectively making up the largest unit of hospitals really in the world, they are projecting that they will exceed their ICU capacity by July 6th. That's next week. There's such a large compilation of hospitals that speaks to the number of people now coming down with COVID-19. It's not an issue of testing more people because we know that's not happening. It's that the virus is causing more infection to the point where now Governor Abbott is actually backtracking in terms of the level of openness that the state currently exists. Again, when we had these stay-at-home orders, it was to protect people and to protect our health system. When our largest health system in this country is getting ready to exceed their ICU capacity, that speaks to a failure of protection and a failure of policy to make sure that we were all protected, inclusive of our healthcare heroes.
We have just about a minute and a half for each of you to answer this question. Dr. Taheed, as we look at these most recent numbers, and we know in an economic recovery, consumer confidence is key to a strong and recovering economy. Your thoughts on the mixed messages that we're getting from Pence, who on one hand says, Texas is doing great, every Texan can be proud, and now, to Dr. Hancock's point, now Abbott's having to retract his messages. What does this do to consumer confidence?
Well, Abbott has to respond to his voters; otherwise, he'll be voted out. Pence doesn't govern in Texas, and so the Texas voters understand that what the Texas governor is saying is the truth, and what the vice president is saying is just more business politics as usual. And so, the idea that you have these mixed messages among Republicans, Texas is a red state, means that even Republicans who are supporters of Pence and Trump are understanding that they've been duped, and they are, I imagine, planning to hunker down, to follow the governor's orders to shut down the economy again. But that creates a level of uncertainty that means that people will hold on to their cash and not spend it.
Okay.
And so that lack of confidence it magnifies the existing recession.
And Dr. Hancock, same question to you from a public health confidence perspective. You've got these mixed messages coming from Pence, and even Deborah Birx said that
right.
You can see. Go ahead.
I'm not convinced that people will do the right thing. If they did, we wouldn't be in this position in the first place. When this issue is politicized and people make decisions based on their politics and not their health, you're going to see numbers continue to rise. It won't be until true enforcement happens with these mandates that people will feel compelled to practice social distancing and wearing masks. They're not going to do it simply because the numbers are increasing. If that were the case, they would have been doing it a long time ago.
As we look towards flu season coming at the middle of September or the end of September, this is going to be off the charts?
It's going to be off the charts, off the chain, and all of that. I pray for all of my healthcare colleagues because we will be busy all the way through into the spring. And it's unfortunate.
And so, Linwood, 30 seconds, as this continues to spike and we get closer to the election, there's no rebound for the economy.
Exactly. This becomes very, very much politicized all the way to the election. For both Republicans and Democrats, there's a correlation that I think is interesting, that the countries that have responded the best to the coronavirus are those countries that have universal health care.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Well, thank you both very much, Dr. Yolandra Hancock, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Thank you both very much, folks. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Common Dreams reports, with election just 4 months away, the FEC essentially defunct as GOP member leaves for Koch-funded group. After 10 months, the Federal Elections Commission in May regained a quorum with the confirmation of Republican appointee Trey Traynor and promptly lost that just over 5 weeks later on this past Friday when Commissioner Caroline Hunter resigned to join the Koch-funded group Stand Together, leaving the regulatory body again essentially powerless as the November general election draws closer. Should this be of concern to Americans? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He is a man who's been called the most important investigative reporter of our time, up there with Woodward and Bernstein. That's from The Guardian. He has broken front page stories for BBC Television Newsnight, The Guardian, Nation Magazine, and now Rolling Stone. He is, of course, Greg Pallas. Greg, as always, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Glad to be with you, and it is critical.
And so how concerned are you amongst all of the problems that we are continuing to have with these elections? The focus, for example, with 60 Minutes last night was on mail-in ballots. No mention, of course, this, they did their story before this broke, but the FEC, nobody's paying attention to this.
Yeah, and we should, because it's sick. What's happening is the Federal Elections Commission, they're basically the elections cops, okay? They're the people that are supposed to stop people from taking money illegally, spending it illegally. You know, we have the most bought elections on this planet in a developed nation, supposedly, but that's our problem. And without the FEC having what they, you know, we use the fancy term a quorum. They don't have enough people make a decision. So if, you know, like, and in fact, in a way, how they lost their quorum shows you the excessive influence of money. So the Koch brothers, the Koch Industries, the Koch-backed charities, now David Koch just passed away, but you still have Trump's buddy Billy Koch, and Charles Koch, of course, is the richest, worth about $60 billion. So how do you stop the FEC from saying you've done illegal campaign contributions? And I want to remind you that, if you know me, Greg Palast, I did the first investigation of the Kochs documentary back in 1995, the richest guys you've never heard of, they were making illegal corporate campaign contributions, which I was one of the people who busted them, back in the 90s. And that's the FEC. So the FEC ultimately fined these guys and put a limit on what they could do. But now what they've done is, to get the cops off the beat, they literally buy one of the commissioners and just give her a job. So now the FEC doesn't have enough votes to say anyone's committing an illegal act. Cut it out. Give back the money. Dirty money. You can't use it in our campaigns. Hey, we just literally don't have enough members of the commission to bust the bad guys.
And so it's important, first of all, for people to understand the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, it's an independent regulatory agency. And what they do is they oversee and enforce campaign finance law in U.S. elections. And so, as I understand it, since they have not been able to have a quorum, they now have this huge backlog of cases that they're not able to oversee or make any determinations on. We're 4 months away from the election, and now is crunch time when you would like to be sure that the guard dog in your front yard is actually guarding the front yard.
Right, and literally, the guard dog is off the chain and gone. So this is the problem. And it's also, remember, that it's reporting. So we want to know whose money is behind these candidates. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. So they'll hide it. They'll cheat. And the FEC is there to bust them. But now there's no base cop on the beat. So it's funny. The only response to defund the police has been defunding the elections police. The guys with the guns are still out on the street, but the elections police, no, they are getting killed. And by the way, also a related agency, the Elections Assistance Commission, has been all but destroyed by defunding by Trump. Because that, if you look, oh, by the way, I have a new book out, Wilmer, that's coming out mm-hmm. July 14th. You can get it now, called How Trump Stole 2020. And I use the figures from the U.S. Elections Assistance Commission on the number of African-Americans who have been blocked from the voter rolls, whose votes don't get counted. Believe it or not, there's an agency that actually tracks this stuff, and they're trying to kill that one too. So that's also way under the radar, that they have just completely killed off the Federal Elections Commission, which tracks who has been shafted out of their vote. And then you, by the way, might as long as you're going down the agencies that have been stabbed in the back, how about the U.S. Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department? These are the voting cops. Well, now they're all under the thumb of Bill Barr, the Attorney mm-hmm. General. So mm-hmm. Again, voting police, the voting protection police out of the Justice Department, they ain't there. They're missing in action. So the defunding of police has happened, but it's defunding of elections police. That's the problem.
And that, I think, is very important for people to understand, because one of the problems that I've been having with the process, and you, for example, have been very effective at bringing lawsuits and trying your best, you along with others such as Reverend Jackson and Rainbow Push, you have been very effective in trying to get the courts to hold these individuals accountable. But the problem is the lawsuits come after the election has been held. And so, yeah, you can have a victory. You can have a tremendous victory in the court, but getting an election overturned is incredibly difficult. So we need these folks on the front end, watching the barn on the front end, instead of coming into the barn after the cow's already out.
Yeah, but that's what we're missing. And one of the problems in what you're saying about having to act in advance, we lost a lot of that power when this Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act of 65. So for people to understand what happened, what the Supreme Court did was remove something called preclearance. Now, that's a fancy term, but what it means is states like Georgia and Alabama and New York and Arizona and Alaska can't be shafting voters of color out of their vote by using procedures like mass purges, closing voting stations, et cetera, because before they did that, they would have to run these things by the federal government and certify that there's no negative racial effect. And I'm telling you, when you talk about removing, are you ready? 16.7 million voters from the voter rolls in the last 2 years. 16.7 million. It's in How Trump Stole 2020. That's why I call the book, by the way, How Trump Stole 2020, because we've already removed 16.7 million voters. And by the way, if you're listening, please make sure it's not you. It was me. I looked my name up and it said Greg Pallas, no such voter in California. I had to re-register. Don't end up being one of the 1 in 12 voters who are losing their vote, and it's overwhelmingly young people and voters of color. You're listening to this. Check with your Board of Elections. Check with your state or vote.org and see if you're still registered, because there's a very good chance you aren't.
How long had you been registered in California before you realized that you were no longer registered in California?
I didn't wait very long. I walk the walk, man. I tell people to check their registration. And so I was only a few months. I had registered at the DMV when I moved here.
Okay.
But they didn't. But they, there's all kinds of technical reasons why you fill out that form and they still don't put your name on. And by the way, while I supposedly had my name on and then I was able, but then it wasn't there, I re-registered, my assistant producer, a young African-American, he had to go back half a dozen times to the DMV with all kinds of crazy ID. They even told him, we won't let you get a driver's license unless you show us your passport. So the and understand, I walk in, we both walk in. I'm the older white guy, and they say, and I say, here's my new address. They say, thank you, here's your new driver's license, here's your form for elections. He's behind me, same story. He just moved to California to work with me, and they send him away, young black male. This is the problem of America, and it's whether it's DMV, policing, voting, all these things go together, and it's never going to be overcome till you have the voting power to cut this stuff out. I mean, Jim Crow has got to go.
And the stereotype of California is that it's this liberal bastion of politics. Everybody runs around California smoking weed, listening to Led Zeppelin, and voting.
Chilling, right? but you know what? I got to tell you, there's a chapter in the book called California Reman, and it's about how in California, we have one party, of course, the one state system, a one party state. And therefore, the attacks are Democrats versus Democrats. And particularly, once again, it's low-income people, it's young people, it's voters of color who are getting shafted in California by the Democratic establishment. So it's in most states, it's the Republican Party, no question, because who has the advantage in removing voters of color? It's going to be the Republicans. And they are really getting very, very good at it. But again, you can overcome the steal. They can't steal all the votes all the time. You know, Barack Obama, when I wrote the book Billionaires and Ballot Bandits with Bobby Kennedy, he called up Obama to ask him what he knew about this, you know, the vote suppression stuff we were uncovering. And he was very knowledgeable. And so the question is, why wasn't he pounding the table and screaming? His mm-hmm. view was, and I don't necessarily agree with him on it, but just overcome the steal. There was no question. We calculated pretty carefully. He lost 5.9 million votes, but he overcame it. He just overwhelmed it. Same thing happened in Wisconsin, where they played every game in the world to steal the state house in Wisconsin and keep Scott Walker, the right-wing freak, as governor. But he was thrown out despite ID laws, mass purges, you name it. They did everything they could to block voters of color in Milwaukee. They still lost, and Scott Walker was thrown out. A new governor was put in an African-American lieutenant governor who's terrific, progressive, and fighting these issues, Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes. And we can overcome the steal. And by the way, it's not whether I'm for or against Trump. That doesn't matter. I'm not partisan on this. If the American people want this kind of orange-stained, bloviating bigot as a president, well, okay, that's democracy. But
you get what you vote for.
Vote. Yeah, but when you steal that vote, he wasn't elected president. And we can basically steal it back. That is, at the back of the book, I have something called a ballot condom for safe voting. It's just tips on how you protect your vote. Indeed, you can protect your vote, doctor, and we've just got to work hard. And it's not just hoping that they will change the laws. We've got to take responsibility, including, by the way, if you read how Trump stole 2020, you'll find out how they take your vote, but also how to protect your vote. You know that mail-in voting, for example, we have six states that require you to have a witness signature. We've got three states that require you to notarize your mail-in ballot. Be very careful with your mail-in ballot. When ask for it way
that's
in advance.
That's a poll tax.
Yeah, and not only that,
if you have to notarize your ballot, you have to pay to notarize your ballot, that's a poll tax.
It's a poll tax. It's and in some states, about $20 where it's required. So, look, the ACLU of Georgia sued that even the stamps are basically a poll tax to mail in your ballot. Mm-hmm. Remember, Oregon, right. People talk about how Oregon is a good mail-in system. Yeah, it does, but Oregon is not America. Most
right.
states do not have prepaid ballots. Then you have to put in that card that says, yes, I want to vote by mail. If you don't get a card within, say, a month and a half of the election that says, do you want a mail-in ballot, you better call up and demand that ballot because that means you've been purged. You're on some type of list where they're going to block you from voting, or they've just lost you in the system, and you got to fight it.
Let me get you to quickly respond to this, going back to Obama and overwhelm. First of all, if you would quickly, when you said that Donald Trump did not win the election, and a lot of folks will hear that and say, oh, well, that's the Hillary won the popular vote. Donald Trump won the Electoral College. He actually won. But your research shows he didn't win Arizona. If you look at those that were stricken from the rolls, he didn't win Arizona. He didn't win. Well, put it another way. If the people who were stricken from the rolls had been allowed to vote, he would not have won Arizona. He would not have won Michigan. He would not have won Pennsylvania or North Carolina. Speak to that quickly. And that's the same failed logic that Hillary Clinton used against Donald Trump, which was, we will just overwhelm this with turnout.
Couple things. Okay. Trump, if everyone got to vote and every vote were counted, lost. He got, in fact, he was creamed. Okay. I'll just give you one. Michigan. Supposedly Trump won that state by 10,700 votes out of 5 million. Okay, a fragment, okay? Now, 75,355 ballots were never counted in Detroit. Now, they say, we don't know what those people were, how they were voting. Well, who's in Detroit? That isn't exactly Trumpville. This is Motown. I actually flew to Detroit, and I met with some of the voters who lost their votes because 87 scanning machines broke down, vote scanning machines broke down in Detroit. The city had begged the state to give them new voting machines, vote counting machines. These are the scanners before the election. But they said, nah, get lost, because they knew whose votes would be lost. African Americans in Detroit and Hispanics in Detroit. And so they literally did not count those votes that would have given Hillary Michigan. Yet in Wisconsin, you had 182,000 students disenfranchised 2 weeks before the election when the courts ruled that the state could impose a new ID law which disqualified the photo state student IDs issued by the state of Wisconsin to University of Wisconsin students. Well, supposedly Trump won Wisconsin by 22,000 votes out of 5 million, but you didn't count, you knocked out over 100,000 students, and you knocked out over 50,000 African Americans, mostly Milwaukee, who did not have the required ID. That is, you needed an active driver's license. Well, doctor, who doesn't have an active driver's license? people without cars, usually low-income people without cars, urban, who use buses
and
public transport, millennials and low-income people, African-Americans in Milwaukee, and they lost their right to vote in that election. So if you remove students and black folk, excuse me, that's how Trump got a 22,000 vote margin.
Quickly explain Arizona, because I had predicted that Trump would lose Arizona, and that also that Hispanics were going to put Texas in play. Not that the Democrats would win Texas, but that the Republicans would have to spend more money in Texas to cover Texas because of the Latino vote. I was right about Arizona, but unfortunately the numbers didn't turn out that way.
Well, here's the thing. Arizona has had this mass purging of the voter rolls, particularly hitting the Hispanic voters very, very hard. And you look in Trump, how Trump stole 2020, and you'll see that this is the core of it. It is blocking, it is removing voters and then blocking voters from voting. You know, and by the way, Arizona has on its books, and I'm afraid they're going to start enforcing it, you know, that you have to prove you're a citizen to vote. Well, we don't have proof of citizenship in America. Driver's license or Social Security ain't it. My Swiss wife is not a citizen, and she has a driver's license, Social Security. So what happens, they're wiping out voters in Arizona. Again, Arizona should absolutely be a blue state.
Mm-hmm.
But the massive attack on the voter rolls, including a lot of this is coordinated in Arizona, was coordinated by our good friend Chris Kobach of Kansas, Mr. KKK, Chris Kobach of Kansas, who's now running for Senate, by the way, in Kansas. But he was writing the laws, these vicious racist laws for the state of Arizona. And that's one of the big dangers. These guys are really well coordinated. As to not saying anything about it, okay, Stacey Abrams busted that myth. You know, the Democratic Party's been saying, shh, don't say anything about vote suppression. People think their votes won't count, and they won't go and vote. No. Stacey Abrams said, they are shafting us out of our votes. They are using racist Jim Crow tactics. She cited my work.
Mm-hmm.
She specifically said, Greg Palast found out in Georgia, 340,000 people have been wrongly removed from the voter rolls. She raised hell. And as a result, you had a turnout in the midterm election of 2018 that was like nothing they've ever seen. But then they had to turn voters away. In my book, I start out in Georgia with the removal of Martin Luther King's 92-year-old cousin. She's bounced out of polls. That's how Brian Kemp had to win. But it didn't stop Mrs. Jordan, who's 92 years old and needed help and a walker to get into the polling station. She was going to go. She didn't say, oh, well, gee, they might take my vote. No matter what, she was going to go. I was with Raheem Shabazz, a local radio host, and he knew because he saw that his vote, that he was removed from the rolls, but he insisted on showing up anyway and raising hell.
Greg Palast, name of the book?
How Trump Stole 2020.
Get it now. Get it quick. Read it and take action. I got to get out. Thanks, Greg, as always. Really appreciate it.
You're the best. Doctor, thank you. Bye.
Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.